The four speakers to come up and occupy the chairs here in the front. It's the firing line. So I have a set of questions here. And at the same time, Dean Madarmutu indicated that he wanted to make an announcement. Chairman, do you want to make that now? Well, or after? Okay.
Hi, I'm Gail Schmoor. I am a professor in Bano's department, the Department of Geography at McGill. And I'm also director of the Global Environmental and Climate Change Center of Quebec. And I'm the bad cop today. I wore my usual black. I was told to keep everybody on time because there were so many great questions and such passion for these topics that we wanted to have time for everyone to bring forward their questions. And perhaps one of those questions will cover those last couple slides of Sam's, so they have a chance to revisit them. I see people already know the system. They're at the mics. I haven't had a chance to see who got there first. But let's start to my right. The first question.
First, yeah. My name is Felix Van Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist and also a lecturer over at Concordia. I think I'll keep this short. Obviously, we know that water stressing is going to be a huge problem. What is the role, do you think, of GMO crops, gene switching technologies? Is it something you actually want to happen? And what kind of security issues will that be giving us?
Does anyone want to take that?
I'll just jump in here. The problem we're facing with making crops adjusted to higher temperatures is that we don't have much time. Corn increased its yield about 2% per year over the last half of the last century. We probably don't have that much time to really explore the normal ways of, the natural ways of changing crop adaptability to environment. I don't see how we're going to be able to do without the gene jockeys and their expertise in finding ways to improve plant responses to the stresses they're going to face in the future. The two are temperature and water. And already we know that genes have been identified for water stress. If those can be clearly identified and isolated and shown to be possible to introduce in other crops, I have no doubt that that will happen. I don't know if that helps.
Anyone want to add anything to that?
Tomorrow. Thank you.
Is that posed as a question, or did you?
To a question, and also I need some feedback. So, because nobody has just mentioned about this invasive species, these new corridors and stuff, with the climate change.
It sounds like, actually it was expressed quite eloquently, but if anybody has a brief comment as something that was not addressed in his comment?
I can't speak to the pest issue. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert in that, but I do want to address you talked about what can we do to ensure global food security while protecting the environment. And maybe just a brief comment that it's very site-specific or region-specific, I should say. So I think an effort is required maybe at the government level or even at the provincial or state level or smaller level, even finer scale level, to look at what the impacts are in terms of the climate change for the region and then look at their specific expertise in terms of dealing with the problems of environmental degradation and trying to solve it with the local stakeholders and experts. There is no quick fix solution, basically. So it's going to take a lot of money, a lot of time, and a lot of effort.
Little knowledge, I would say that take it into consideration in your food security dimensions, and thank you.
We have one more comment.
I just wanted to add that we have tried to focus on what conditions might be in terms of climate, and given the specific conditions for what corridors would, what kind of temperature and precipitation cycles and whatnot, we can make an assessment of where these are likely to occur. And so there's that aspect of it that we focus on.
I want to say about the connection with climate change and landscape, change of landscape, and crop food security. It's a very hot example. It's the Aral Sea Basin. It's the delta of Amudarya. Because it's not possible to divide these processes, because the water come to delta for scarcity years. The water doesn't come to delta. It means the change landscape, because it's all lakes dried. It means the crop security, food security, because people who live in delta without fish without any food, because it's the normal food for these people is fish, and I think that it's really to look on this process, and I think that it's a different sites for one problem.
I'd just like to add that this issue of plant insect interactions again points out the difficulty of making predictions about what will happen in the future. On the one hand, conditions for plants will be favorable in that CO2 goes up, but with that, the nitrogen concentration in leaves of plants goes down. Now, that's not good for insects. The consequence is they have to eat more, and that's not good for plants. So we don't know what the balance of this is going to be. Moreover, insects are required for plant pollination. Their life cycles are keyed in general to light and temperature. Altering the growing season is bound to alter that interaction. Now, I realize that insects are extremely opportunistic, so I would just like to point out that there are no easy answers when it comes to making predictions about things like plant-insect interactions.
Thank you. Next question.
Thanks. My name is Drew. Sorry. My name is Drew. I'm a student in the School of Environment. I'd like to thank the panel, first of all, for mentioning and stressing the synergistic effects of the impact on crop yields and climate change, because I think that's something that gets overlooked a bit too much in the literature. But you mentioned a theme that came up in a lot of the presentations was this unequal distribution in different regions of the world, and especially seem to be in developed regions of the world. We're having somewhat more of a positive gain from this. And obviously, that, like as a result, for example, of the growing season, which puts kind of a better position on people in developed countries. But in developing countries where they're already operating close to their crop yield limit or temperature limits, then obviously it's that's a negative there. I wanted to ask to pose, I don't know if I can do this without asking ethical approval from McGill or not, but your personal opinions, given that we're likely going to have a bit of a benefit and a lot of people are going to be in a worse-off situation, how do you see the distribution of crop and crop yields and our storage, and how would that interact with the other areas of the world? And perhaps even, I'd like to know the opinion of the whole panel, if it's possible, but Sam Gameda as well, if you could comment on what you think Canada's role would be, that would be fantastic. Thanks.
Thanks. First of all, when you're looking at future climate, well, at least the way we've been looking at it, we're looking at an average of 30-year period in the future. Now, we are taking that further and looking at variability around that. So even though we look at average temperature, precip, and those kind of and related agroclimatic indices, there's also an increase in variability. So, and agriculture is a lot more affected by variability because it can adjust to what types of crops to grow, but it cannot adjust to any great extent to the variability that it's going to be impacted by. So even though we may be complacent in terms of the general outcome, it's not the case when we look at conditions around variability. And some of the early work we've looked at that actually shows that the year-to-year variability could get to be so high that there will be a risk to production. So there's that aspect of it. Beyond that, the aspect you were saying about what that could mean in terms of, I guess, equitable distribution of whatever the preferred outcome here is, that's a tough question. That's a policy related one, and it really depends on what we as citizens choose to do and what our governments choose to do. But I don't know. I would say, given the somewhat competitive and very short-sighted way we look at things, that may be a big issue that we're not going to solve in any substantive way. So whatever inequalities exist now, I wouldn't be surprised if worse ones existed in the future.
Thanks for the question, Drew. I think I don't have a solution, but your question is actually one that preoccupies me a lot, because actually my thesis, I'm looking at how these developed mid-latitudes are going to benefit from crop production. And the unevennesses are going to be more exacerbated between north and south. There's no question about that in my mind. But it also, for me, it brought to light how we in the developed world have to play a greater role in terms of sharing. As a global citizen, I think that it's now up to us in order to take advantage of our opportunity of being able to produce more crops and sort of share it, if you like, with the rest of the world. So my whole hypothesis is that agriculture is going to intensify in the developed countries. And places, for example, like Germany, where historically they have seen in the last 10 years a lot of land abandonment of farms because of the subsidies available to them, are now going to pick up farming practices. And so that can maybe help solve some of the global food security issues if we're up for it, like Sam was saying, if we become citizens of the world. So that's all I can really say, but good question.
Does anyone else want to add anything to that before the next question?
Next question, please.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me join my colleagues to thank the panelists for those excellent presentations that you have made to us this afternoon. I have two comments and maybe, you know, one question to make. One is that we had two meetings in Nairobi. One on the World Development Report that was prepared by the World Bank and launched in Washington and Nairobi simultaneously. And in that, you know, report, there was emphasis to limit the temperature increases to below 2 degrees centigrade. Because beyond that, it would be devastating to crop production, to livestock production, and generally agriculture productivity. That report is there, and I think an official release will be made after it has been adopted. But along with that, we had also the World Agroforestry Congress, the second World Agroforestry Congress held in Nairobi within 2 weeks of that meeting. And again, a lot of resolutions, increasing agroforestry and building capacity for agroforestry and integrating forestry in crop peak systems. Lots of good information and lots of good ideas came out of that Congress. The problem I have is that who is coordinating the efforts towards climate change globally? Isolated studies and recommendations, and people are saying they're waiting for Copenhagen, where issues of climate change will be discussed. The poor and the rich countries have their own stories to tell during that meeting. But time has been lost up here, and maybe I would like to suggest to the panelists and to the people who are here today, the participants in this meeting, we want to live here with an understanding of how best we can sensitize countries to start concerted efforts, coordinated efforts towards climate change. But more importantly, I would like to see more of Bano Medis. You are one, but we want to see many of you talking about climate change. And I would like to think that it is time now, again, reemphasizing what I said yesterday, that capacity building in those areas must be done. Climate change, agroforestry, and all environmental issues. I think more focus must be done. But the question is, who is to ensure that is done? I think possibly the panelists have an answer to that. Thank you very much. My name is Ephraim Mukisira from Kenya Agriculture Research Institute. Thank you.
Thank you. So who's going to address, who should be making the effort and sensitize?
I can't address who should be doing this. In what has happened with Kyoto and what is shaping up to happen with Copenhagen, I don't expect there's going to be a concerted effort around it. So I think what needs to happen is for developing countries to take whatever mitigative efforts they can. One other area I work in is actually the effect of land use on climate. And we're able to find, for example, in the Canadian prairies that land use change that has resulted in over 25 years and an increase in increased crop area, crops on agricultural land of something like 6 million hectares had actually reduced maximum temperatures, reduced solar radiation, increased humidity, and to some extent precipitation. So revegetating land in the prairies, especially appropriate areas of land in the prairies, not in the prairies, in the tropics, could have regional impacts that might be worth pursuing. If you look at the last slide, that was actually not too far from my hometown in Ethiopia, and if you looked at the hills, there are very few trees on that. In fact, in certain areas, there's sloping areas that are being used for agricultural production. I would like to look at what impacts, if those areas are reforested, that would have on regional climates and the hydrological cycle in that. But beyond that, I would say, you know, the developing countries basically have to take measures on their own.
Anybody else?
Sorry. About land change of land use, I know and we work with a program, NESPI, and NASA program, which maybe long, 15, maybe 20 years. They work with the satellite image, and they prepare reports about the change of land land cover. I think that because we are area Asia and Siberia, we work with specialists who work with this area, but I know that this program dealing the land cover change for all world. But about the climate change, I know I hear is a result of the program IPCC, and I know that this program is the program, and each country prepares the report for each maybe I don't know exactly 2 or 3 years. And in Central Asia, we work with the data of these reports, because we are not specialists of climate, but we when we calculate the water requirement and water demand, we use the data of this report. Because it's the same methodology, the same models for all world. I think that it's for compare. It's need use this data and for each work.
I'd love to make a comment before we go to this next question. I think that's a very difficult question to answer. We've probably invested as much or more into predicting or making projections of climate than we have into adaptation and impact studies, which probably need, my personal feeling is it needs to be done anyway, whether there's climate change or not. There is still a great deal to be done in the world, but there's such a huge emphasis on the prediction side, and the second two working groups of the IPCC don't seem to get quite as much of much attention, and they don't have as much to work on. And hopefully people will start to realize that, but I think only by throwing these questions out to not just this panel, but getting onto those work groups that are going to Copenhagen and other places to stay vocal on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jean Lebel, CRD, IDRC, International Development Research Center. You're stealing my punch, because I think that I want to congratulate the panel on the quality of the presentation, also in soundness of the research data that are behind this from multiple sources, and I really appreciate that. I think that you have been concentrating mostly on the impacts of climate change, and as the co-chair was mentioning, food security is a human dimension also issue. And the human dimension in climate change is at least as important, if not more important on the adaptation side, and we haven't heard much about adaptation, particularly in the context of development, as IPCC pointed out, that, you know, while the mitigation burden falls on the developed world and also on growing economy like China and like India, the most affected and the most vulnerable are the ones living, you know, in the tropical belt and in many developing regions of the world. So I'd like to have your views as a panel as a whole, you know, what should be those priorities for adaptation research, because ultimately this is something that is taking place right now. The donors are in that direction. It's a significant portion of the talk in Copenhagen, and whether there's a deal at Copenhagen, adaptation, as you were mentioning, is going to be required. So I'd like to get your views on this. Thank you.
So, priorities.
Thank you for the question. In my previous life, I was coordinator for an adaptation research network in Canada, looking at water resources impacts adaptation. And I think what we learned is that it's very tough to push adaptation in developing countries, because for them the priorities lie completely elsewhere. In developing countries, their priorities are where to find food for to survive, for the most cases. So unfortunately, although there is a real need for adaptation, especially in these countries as we've seen, unfortunately, my feeling is that it gets pushed to a lower priority level because there's other priorities that are more urgent, let's say. And on another comment, perhaps, even in developed countries such as Canada, the adaptation issue just came to the forefront very, very recently, and even now it's not getting as much money, as Gail was saying, and attention as the science or the other aspects, the mitigation aspects as well. But it is important. Hopefully we'll raise awareness. It's a very tough question to answer, but those are my thoughts.
Is there a particular top three, I'm following up on his question, top three things that should be addressed? What should be on somebody's research agenda? Anybody?
Well, in general, plants can adapt to new environments. They've been doing it for a very long time. But we now have to help them because the time is very short. So I would say one of the major research agendas in the area that I know anything about has to do with understanding how plants can be modified to adapt to the new conditions that they're going to face in the next 4 or 5 decades. I would say that's a major research area. In the area of fundamental research, before we get too far with that, we have to learn what the rules are for plants responding to rising CO2. Remember, CO2 has been relatively stable in the atmosphere for quite a while. Plants have adjusted to that. And now they're going to have to adjust to much, much higher CO2 levels than they have seen in millions of years. Are they capable of doing that? Is that beyond the range that most of the crop plants we depend on can do? Those questions haven't been answered. So I would say we have to do basic research on how to help plants adapt to the new conditions.
Anyone else with anything to add? Okay, we have a feeling we might have some ideas coming up from the questions and comments.
Thank you, ma'am. First of all, I would like to thank the panelists for their informative presentation. My question is related to actually methane production in the polar areas. Actually, you mentioned that because of CO2, there is global warming. Because of global warming, there is the ice is melting in the polar areas. Because of that, fermentation is taking place there of the plants which has been buried there for some years. So because of that, CH4, that is methane, is produced. And in a cyclic way, it is going to increase the temperature of the world further because it is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2. So I would like your ideas about the effect of that plant, means effect of that particular gas, other than increasing the temperature of world. Is it having any direct effect on the plant production? As you mentioned that CO2 is going to have some positive effect on the plant production, I would like to have your views regarding methane, actually. Thank you.
I'll have a stab at that, and it's going to be very quick. I don't know of any direct effects of methane on plant production that would be the least bit useful to us at this stage. And I would like to thank you for raising that really important issue. If the Arctic warms as much as we think it's going to, methane will begin to rise once again. Historically, geologically, methane has been tied to the monsoons, and that's been tied to the intensity of solar radiation in June and July in tropical regions. The solar radiation, we're in a cycle now where the solar radiation is declining, and the monsoons should be weakening naturally. I think we're doing things to the climate that are making them more erratic, and you've heard something about that earlier. But it may even be that even with an increase in the methane production in the Arctic, there would be a long-term reduction in methane production from natural sources in middle or low-latitude areas.
Thank you. Next question.
Hello. My name is Lazar Conforti. I'm from Equitaire. Hello again. My question has to do with one of the methods that we have devised to deal with climate change, and that is the carbon market, the carbon offset market. I'm particularly interested in the particular variant of it called the clean development mechanism, which is where a polluter from a developed country gets to, if they wish to keep polluting, gets to buy an offset from a developing country. Now, this is very different from cap and trade because the developing countries, or Annex II countries in the Kyoto jargon, don't have a cap. So it's actually a net increase in pollution, and these offset credits that are coming from the CDM are actually more of a permit to increase your pollution as opposed to being a real offset. So, but more specifically to this conference, what has been documented is that carbon brokers and investors are buying up land, agricultural land, and turning it into carbon capture projects, which tend to be tree plantations, often of foreign species, such as eucalyptus and teak, which also have a high value in timber. So I guess it's kind of the same debate that we had in the previous session, the food versus fuel questions. It's been documented, at least at the grassroots level, by NGOs like Friends of the Earth and Carbon Trade Watch, that there is a food versus right to pollute debate going on as well. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. And I know you might not be the experts in this question, but it's also, as I said, it's been documented at the grassroots level, and I think this question and this debate is missing at conferences like these and other places. Thank you.
Does anyone have a comment?
I think you'd have gotten more mileage out of this if you'd spoken. You'd asked this in the previous panel. I'm personally not very knowledgeable about the mechanisms around the clean development mechanisms, and my understanding in terms of the how it's supposed to function is that. There is a cost to those that are polluting, so maybe there'll be an incentive for them to reduce their pollution in the process. There's some land offset for production, appropriate land offset for increased forestry and where it can be. But if there are other issues around who's buying up that land and who's trying to get the benefits from it, I'm not aware of that. So personally.
I am Jose.
I've been told we have just a couple time for a couple questions.
Okay. I have only a small contribution and also a question for the panelists. The small contribution is about fertilizer. Can you hear me well? Well, the contribution is about the scenario in 2050. We will have 9 billion people to feed, so it's about 30-40% of increase. We will have also increase some land uses, like, for instance, in Canada, instead of wheat, it will be corn. Also, there will be an increase of other agriculture will be also used not only for biofuel but for biomass, such as products such as methanol for making green chemistry. So my question is, all these new changes will be a huge amount of new fertilizers because for increasing yields, not only is necessary more water, but also more fertilizers. And there, for potassium and for phosphorus, there is, limited resources. And for nitrogen is made by synthesis in all the developed countries from hydrogen and from nitrogen, and it needs a lot of pressure, a lot of temperature, so you have a lot of you have to burn natural gas, coal, or fossil fuels. So my question is, have you calculated how much will be the increase of use of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphate? Which scenario and which quantities will be needed? Because I guess it's much more usually for increasing 10% the yield, you have to put double quantity of increase. That's mm-hmm.
So who's calculated how much more fertilizer we'll need?
I could take this. I guess I'm not really on the panel, but as an agricultural worker, I mean, people are aware of this, but they haven't actually done the math. I mean, we're still coming to grips in part with how much the yield increase will be. But I think the comment is certainly a valid one. There will be requirements for increases in things like nitrogen fertilizer, which draws in with it the increase in potential energy expenditures associated with crop production and increase in nitrous oxide emissions, which are, of course, it's a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2 and than methane. So there are a whole series of problematic things that come with that. We have to think this through.
So is there any research going on right now where people are trying to do this? I pushed that further. Does anyone actually have this right up at the top of their research agenda to calculate this, or you're just too afraid?
I think there's piecemeal things going on out there where people are looking at what the increase might be, and then you'll see a paper come out where somebody says, well, in our location where this is happening, we're going to increase the end requirement for the crop by this much. There's other things you have to factor into that after that. If you've got increased fertilizer additions, but you've got increased rainfall events, you're going to increase leaching at the same time. It's not as straightforward as you'd think, mm-hmm. but people are thinking about it, but maybe not over large scales and not as carefully as probably as we should mm-hmm. be at this time. But yeah.
I'd like to just add, also, I think one of the main challenges to answering that question is land use. We just don't know what the land use changes are going to be in the future, what the future crop distributions or choices are going to be, and what their requirements are. So it's not a straightforward question to answer.
They're hard questions. And another hard question.
Hi, my name's Colleen. I'm a student at McDonald campus. Over the last few days, we've heard a lot of talk about economic numbers and how much we need to increase investment by the year 2050 given the population. And it's my understanding, and I believe one gentleman at the public lecture section mentioned that those estimates include something like 80% increase in yields in developing countries, so or upward somewhere in that range. And I'm wondering if anyone on the panel knows if those economic models are integrated at all with climate models and how realistic those numbers may be given the current climate situation, if there's a disconnect between economic thinking and climate research.
I'd just like to make an opening comment on that. I've seen people piggyback economic models on climate models, which adds a significant degree of uncertainty to a significant degree of uncertainty. And
all I can add is that there's huge uncertainty here. I've not looked at climate models coupled with economic models, but I can tell you that the overwhelming story that is being told by people who examine crop productivity into the future as a result of climate change is that crop productivity will suffer. So if the projections are that there's an 80% increase in demand for yield in crops over the next 50 years, climate is going to work against that. That is not a very happy thought, and as was pointed out in the open session on Monday afternoon, it's very difficult to feel secure about our food in the future when you combine the economic, social, and particularly climate change impacts on our capacity to produce it, especially in a way that will nourish people the way they're supposed to be.
I just want to quickly add that I am aware of two models European-wide. One is called EU Ruralis, and the second one is GTAP. And those are two very complex models that integrate a climate component with an economic modeling component for the sole purpose to look at what agricultural demands are going to be in the future. So that might be something you can look at, certainly. I can't speak on how good they are. But
are they from Potsdam?
No, Euralis is Holland, and GTAP is UK perhaps, but Potsdam might be involved. They're Europoint.
There's also, if you're interested in economy and climate, the Potsdam Institute has a lot of funding from the EU to look at that, and they're doing some very progressive, tightly linked work in that regard. And we have one last question before the break, and then the final comments that follow that.
Thank you very much. I would like to again thank the panelists for such enlightening presentations. Mine is more of a contribution. My name is Paul Mapumo. I've been involved in climate change adaptation research with communities in across seven different countries in Africa over the past 20 years. Thanks to the IDRC for supporting that. My observation or experience working in Africa with communities is that one of the characteristics of climate change and variability is the changes that happen in rainfall and temperature regimes across very short distances within subregions. And this entails then that adaptation is really hinged on the internal response mechanisms of the communities affected by particular factors. And I would really urge and want to see more emphasis on how we support those communities at a very local scale, because they are the ones who are going to respond and adapt to be able to do that. And I sort of didn't hear much of that. I could hear much of the projections and so on. But I think that's a very critical element we are finding on the ground, is farmers are changing. In Mali, people are changing from growing cotton because pests have become a problem because of the changes in flowering time of cotton. And we're seeing similar changes across different regions for different crops. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have a comment?
Quick comment. Thank you, Paul. I agree that that's a particular issue. And in fact, I've tried to look at things like seasonal forecasting that will try to address issues like that, and the skill in those types of things and how they could be improved. Related to that, some observational data in these areas where there is substantial variability, to be able to feed that into improving forecast models. But yeah, in terms of the variability of temperature and climate within these, to be able to have a more secure production, you do need some level of reliable projections to be able to practice agriculture at a at a seasonal level, not at a projected future level.
Any other comment? Last comment? Thank you all. And now to...
I'm the dean has left the room, so I have to make his announcement for him. But it's not too exciting, just to, you know, refreshments are available, but he's asked that you partake of the refreshments and return to your seats fairly quickly because they want to move on to the last plenary session as soon as possible. So just that. Don't dally near the coffee.